There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast bringing together all the best bits of the business breakfast from Wednesday, the 22nd of January.
Our top story is about tourism. On holiday. $16.73 million tourists in Dubai. Count them all in 2019. It did set a new record for Dubai. It was up about 5% year on year. But of course, Dubai is not looking to the past. It is looking to the future. Comments from His Excellency Halal Sayed Al Mari, who's the Director General of Dubai Tourism. He said the following: what we need to offer to continue this growth is the following: unique and transformative tourism experiences and radical innovation. Those aren't our words, they're his words. So we've been asking you this morning, what do you think that Dubai should be doing in terms of transformative tourism experiences and radical innovation? We've had loads of messages in today. Thank you very much indeed for those. Some of us have been serious and sensible. Many of them have made us laugh. Some of them we can't repeat. But let's give you a flavour of what we've had. John, for example, points to the Caesars Palace Hotel on Blue Waters Island as perhaps a model going forward. I'm not giving any more details on that. We've had others who were suggesting we need more eco-friendly and environmentally conscious tourism because that is what millennial travellers want to do.
Yeah, that was a very big theme. I mean, that's the big theme of Davos at the moment as well. So unsurprising that that has come through. Look, the numbers are good in that, as you say, they're a record. Dubai Tourism has also come out and said that the spending from those tourists, the 16.73 million of them, has contributed over 10% of Dubai's GDP, 11.5%. And we haven't seen a huge amount of change in the top source markets. India is still number one, Saudi Arabia number two, and Saudi, the biggest provider of visitors from the Gulf. We've seen a bit of a switch when it comes to China and Russia, though. China is now providing nearly a million visitors, coming in at fifth place in terms of source markets. Both China and Russia benefiting greatly, we've said it time and time again, from the visa on arrival scheme.
It's so important, isn't it? Russia as well, three quarters of a million. And again, we have a visa on arrival from them. India, the biggest tourism destination. We don't quite have visa on arrival, but now any Indian who has a US visa can just walk in. So it's getting easier.
Do you know the one that actually amazes me?
Tell me.
Quietly there at number four is Oman.
Bizarre.
Because you've got the UK at number three, China at number five, Saudi Arabia, India, populous nations, the world's most populous nations on this list, Russia, China, Saudi, India, the UK, tiny population-wise compared to those other nations, but then Oman in at number four.
4.6 million people.
Is everybody coming twice?
It's clearly a thing.
It clearly is a thing. So that is the big surprise for me, just in terms of demographics alone. Oman punching well above its weight on that list there.
Some comments we've had in today point out that it's all well and good getting the volume of visitors, nearly 17 million, but if they're not spending money, what's the point? And someone wrote in, no name on this, says, if this is all people who are checking into hotels with pot noodles in their bags that they've brought from home, then that's not great. That's not going to give the economy too big a hit. Which got us thinking, and it sparked a bit of a debate on the Business Breakfast, is it okay to take your own food to a hotel? And if it is okay, how much is too much?
I took oats, nuts, seeds and almond milk to a hotel this weekend. And it wasn't because I was, and I didn't take the breakfast. It was because I need to get a lot of work done. And I thought, Brandy, you right now do not need an unlimited buffet in your dietary requirements. You need the opposite of an unlimited anything. Stay in your room, do your work, eat some muesli. The amount of people who've got in touch with us this morning, and you know what? They're blaming the hotels. They're basically saying, if we're coming in with our Spinnies carrier bags, it is your fault, and it is your fault for charging 15 dirhams for a Snickers bar. It is your fault for having outrageous, and might I say, largely unhealthy snacks in your hotel rooms. So people are proudly sneaking in the food and saying, if you don't like it, charge less.
Yeah, Mooney says, I refuse to pay marked up prices for goods in the minibar. But Mooney says, but I will dine at restaurants. Edmund wrote in saying something similar. A few treats for yourself is okay, but more than that is going too far. CK says, Richard, how would you feel about a house guest bringing their own food and drink and eating it in their room, in your house?
I've bought food and drink to your house before.
Yeah, exactly. It's fine. Saves me a bill. I've been accused of being a Pringle packer, which is apparently a phrase in the industry.
It's an unfortunate phrase.
It's not a compliment for turning up with my family at a couple of bags of the petrol station down the road full of snacks.
But you've got kids. See, I think it's absolutely fine. And I have to say I do it, but I hide my snacks.
Mm.
I'm less subtle. I'm embarrassed about doing it. So I will bring them in a handbag, or I'll pack them in my luggage. I've been known to stop off at Marks and Spencer's before I go.
We've all done it, haven't we?
Yeah. Look, we're going away this weekend. Are you?
I'm not, no. Because it's the Dubai Eye Executive Golf Day. The golf is tomorrow, but we're all staying up at the Waldorf Astoria tonight.
I am going to relinquish my whole you don't need it and all you can eat and drink buffet, because I am absolutely going to be into that breakfast buffet, because I know it is one of the UAE's finest.
Except you're not, because you're going to be presenting the business breakfast. So you're going to be on air.
Okay, I'm staying for the weekend, so will be many times. But you raise an interesting point. I will be presenting the business breakfast. What's going to happen to my breakfast?
I don't know. I'm going to be playing golf. I'm going to be fine.
I'm going to assume that there's going to be an early breakfast just for me.
If you're joining us up there, because sadly now, registrations are now closed. But if you are joining us up there tonight, we really look forward to seeing you. We've got an incredible lineup of things. It is to give it its full title, the Dubai Eye Executive Golf Day, driven by BMW, hosted by Alhambra Group, in association with Rackbank Elite and Ella Containers. The BMW bit is really exciting. If anyone gets a hole in one tomorrow, the person who gets it is driving off in a new BMW X7, which is the bee's knees, and all their teammates get a BMW 7 Series. Happy days.
Yep.
Not for BMW. It's not happy days, but it's happy days for the team.
Well, we will see how that goes. Richard got a hole in one in 1973. We'll see if he can repeat that.
That would be nice to have. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Dubai Eye 103.8. Other stories that we're looking at today, and there are many of them doing the rounds at the moment, Brandy Scott, aren't there? We've been looking at bullying in some detail today.
Yeah, we have. This is on the back of an extremely disturbing report that has come out over the last few days. It's come out from the Chartered Institute for the Professionals who deal basically with HR here in not just the UAE, but around the world, the CIPD. And we've been speaking to the organisation behind that report. Charlotte Shedeville is Senior Programme and Project Manager of the CIPD here in the Middle East. The findings in a nutshell were that 15% said that they had been the victims of bullying or harassment in the last 3 years. Less than half reported it. And we asked Charlotte why she thought that was.
There are several factors that come into play here. And obviously one of the barriers to reporting such behaviours is a lack of leadership. Our research showed that, of course, a fear factor is huge, as well as a lack of procedures and, most importantly, a lack of training from the line managers. So we hope that these researchers, as a wake-up call for employers to put their line managers in trainings and to put them at the heart of efforts to prevent inappropriate workplace behaviour and know how to address it properly as well.
Well, the Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development is an international organisation. This was a UK report. But we said to Charlotte, what do you think is happening here?
The report is primarily focused on the UK. However, at the CIPD, we work with a number of partners here in the region, and both firms like Clyde & Co. or AXA's Employee Assistant Programme have confirmed that it is a similar situation here. It's also quite a timely report because at the end of last year, there have been some movements in the UAE law here where they have put in place new laws, anti-discrimination provisions. There is an interest in recognising that's an issue and starting to address it in the region, which is a good start.
Well, we spoke to someone on the front line this morning, Dr. David Lee, consultant clinical psychologist at the American Centre for Psychiatry and Neurology here in Dubai. He speaks to people about the stuff that's bothering him every single day. And so we asked him, what are you hearing? How big an issue is bullying in Dubai?
Well, it comes up time and time again, actually, you know, in some way, shape or form, it seems to be there. I mean, I would say it comes up on a weekly basis, often covert forms of bullying, you know, veiled threats, which obviously concerns people financially. You know, it has a big psychological impact on people. And sometimes that can be sustained over time. So, you know, you hear stories where, you know, I find myself thinking, well, how long has this really gone on for? You know, really kind of unfair treatment over time. It could be the appraisal, the annual appraisal, that time and time again reflects badly on this individual. But you kind of get a sense that they're being singled out for, poor performance, if you like. I think we downplay the impact that, bullying can have on the workplace and how widespread it can be.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We are talking workplace behaviour this morning, worrying workplace behaviour. We've got a new survey from the Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development. It says that a quarter of employees reckon that their companies are turning a blind eye to bullying and harassment. Around 15% have experienced it in the past 3 years, but less than half have reported it. We are joined now in the studio by Dr. David Lee, consultant clinical psychologist at the American Centre for Psychiatry and Neurology here in Dubai. Dr. David, it's lovely to see you again. Thanks for joining us. What did you make of the report?
Yeah, it's a very interesting report. I mean, you know, some striking statistics there. First of all, 15% of individuals who've reported bullying over the last 3 years. But I guess what's more worrying is this statistic around, you know, a quarter of employees believing that their employers are actually turning a blind eye to it. It's worrying because we know that bullying is a problem. You know, we know the psychological impact that bullying can have, and that impact is widespread and varied.
You mean, you talk to people all day about what is bothering them. How big an issue do you think it is here?
Well, it comes up time and time again, actually. You know, in some way, shape or form, it seems to be there. I mean, I would say it comes up on a weekly basis. Often covert forms of bullying, veiled threats, which obviously concerns people financially. You know, it has a big psychological impact on people, and sometimes that can be sustained over time. So, you know, you hear stories where, you know, I find myself thinking, well, how long has this really gone on for? You know, really kind of unfair treatment over time. It could be the appraisal, the annual appraisal, that time and time again reflects badly on this individual. But you kind of get a sense that they're being singled out for, poor performance, if you like. Yeah, I think we downplay the impact that, bullying can have on the workplace and how widespread it can be.
You mentioned their veiled threats and veiled financial threats. I mean, you've obviously worked in a number of different countries. The fact that here your work is not just your wages, but it is for many people, you know, it's also your visa, your kids' school fees, your housing, the ability for your entire family to stay in Dubai. How does that alter the mix?
Well, I think the fact that people's livelihood actually, you know, is at stake here, you know, 100%, that if you're an employee, you're on your company's visa. You know, if you couple that with those veiled threats about employment and finances, and of course we know that cost of living is high, people have got families, you know, school fees, you know, all of these things that need to be paid that stack up, then people, when they're being bullied and those threats are being made, it affects the mental health. Of course it does. It leads to worry, it leads to sleepless nights, it can lead to depression, a whole range of things that can really impact, you know, not just on the well-being of that person, but thinking in terms of productivity. Of course it affects productivity.
Of course, and this is your other hat, isn't it? I mean, you also do a huge amount of business and executive coaching.
Right.
So if we move away from the mental health of the individual, what does it mean for the health of a company?
Yeah, I mean, it affects the psychological health of the company, the productivity, you know, relationships within the company. Of course, we know, bullying, just like, you know, very authoritative, you could say nuclear leadership, it isn't helpful. It affects morale in staff. It affects self-esteem at a physical level. You know, I've already alluded to sleep, but if employees are not sleeping well, of course, that's going to affect productivity across the board.
So what can be done about it?
Well, I mean, I think it needs to be tackled at a number of levels. Organisations need to take it very, very seriously. So I talk about, you know, what I call a whole organisation approach. We can't just kind of send employees off to have some psychological therapy or some counselling to talk about the stresses and strains in the workplace. We need to tackle the real issue. Where is bullying taking place? Often, companies, organisations, they're blind to where it could be taking place. So we need to have a look out for those blind spots. It's not always the managers that are bullying, for example. It can be colleagues, you know, it can be grudges that are being held by colleagues.
It can be HR. I mean, I have to say, a huge amount of the messages we've gotten in this morning aren't necessarily pointing the finger at the boss, it's pointing the finger at the HR department.
That's right, yeah. And that's not to say that all HR departments are bullying, of course, but, you know, it's a fine balance. HR's role is there to support the company, but also the employees as well. But it's a story I hear, you know, worryingly at times.
We've had a specific example from someone who signs off anonymous, which is fine.
Sure.
Bullying is a huge issue. I was told to wear short skirts to events, and when I challenged my boss's awful behaviour, I was sacked under the guise of restructuring. What can people do when something like that happens? Maybe I should be asking that question to a lawyer, not a psychologist.
It's very difficult, isn't it? Yeah, I think it's a legal question. You know, we can talk about how unfair that is, of course. I mean, nobody should be asked to do that. You know, there are appropriate questions or directives, if you like, with regard to what is appropriate workplace dress, but nobody should be asked to wear a short skirt in that way. And I think it is a legal question. We're looking at the psychological impact of that and the emotional impact, of course, can have a huge detrimental effect on somebody's self-esteem.
Dr. David Lee, consultant clinical psychologist and business coach at the American Centre for Psychiatry and Neurology here in Dubai. It's lovely to have you, and thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Brandy. Thank you.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. Newsmakers.
The people making the headlines today.
And if you want newsmakers this week, you have to turn your eyes to the Swiss ski resort of Davos, where the World Economic Forum is happening, Brandy Scott.
We do. This morning, we have a lineup of newsmakers, 20 teenagers and one septuagenarian.
I know the latter is Donald Trump.
He is. But we also have Greta and friends, because at Davos this year, for the first time, there is a group of teenage changemakers who have been invited to speak from around the world, from Canada, from South Africa, from New Zealand, from Ireland. Greta, obviously, of course, probably the best known from Bali. Really, really making waves and speaking out. I think it's brilliant.
Let's hear from Greta first of all. This is her talking, of course, about climate.
1 year ago, I came to Davos and told you that our house is on fire. I said I wanted you to panic. I've been warned that telling people to panic about the climate crisis is a very dangerous thing to do. But don't worry, it's fine. Trust me, I've done this before, and I can assure you it doesn't lead to anything. And for the record, when we children tell you to panic, we're not telling you to go on like before. We're not telling you to offset your emissions by just paying someone else to plant trees in places like Africa, while at the same time forests like the Amazon are being slaughtered at an infinitely higher rate.
So Greta, again, making headlines for her speech. The line that has been picked up: if last year it was our house is on fire, this year the line that has really been picked up from her has been her line about basically pretending that you love your children, which has been the big one that she has said, basically. Tackle this for your kids is her big message. But she's not the only person with a message, because she is joined by over half a dozen other young people who are all doing amazing things. One of them is the Anishinaabe water advocate, Autumn Pellia. She has been on this youth panel. Another very outspoken young lady. Really loved her message about how it's not about being praised for what you're doing. Take a listen to this.
I don't want your awards. If you're going to award me with helping me find solutions, award me with helping me make change. And I feel that's what I would want to see, is more people trying to help us with what we're trying to achieve. But then when it comes to federal government, it's really hard to get their attention, be heard by them, because honestly, I would say they're all focused on just money. And we need to be more focused on the actual things going on, and that they're not thinking about the impacts and things that are happening. Like, it's almost like they don't even believe that climate change is real. Like, we all say climate change is a real thing.
And there you go, 15 years old. She was named a water commissioner in Canada, representing 40 First Nations in Ontario. She's been doing it since she was 8 years old, speaking out internationally about water rights for Indigenous people in Canada.
The member of that panel I've picked up on is Natasha Wang Mwansa, who's a Zambian activist. She's a little bit older. She's 18 years old, and she's been making waves for a couple of years now. Now, this is not her speaking yesterday at Davos. What I've picked up on is her speaking at a conference a couple of months ago in Vancouver in Canada. It was the Women Deliver conference, and she was on a panel with Justin Trudeau, the Canadian Prime Minister, and others. But as you can hear, she absolutely brings the house down. And it's not just the message that we're hearing from Natasha and other young people, but the way they deliver it, the gravitas, the presence, the personality is just astonishing. This is Natasha Wang Mwansa.
So we need to bridge the gap between what we want and what is actually provided, and what is promised and what is actually done. Politicians can talk, guys, but yes. Action. No. We need to be able to hold them accountable. Ladies and gentlemen, we need proper mechanisms and channels to hold our politicians, the Prime Minister, the UN Secretary General, each one of us as well.
So that was the voice of youth at Davos over the past 24 hours or so. But as you mentioned, there was a septuagenarian also making waves and making headlines.
Yep, Donald Trump tackling the climate or not, depending on who you're listening to. This is the US president speaking at Davos.
This is not a time for pessimism. This is a time for optimism. Fear and doubt is not a good thought process, because this is a time for tremendous hope and joy and optimism and action. But to embrace the possibilities of tomorrow, we must reject the perennial prophets of doom and their predictions of the apocalypse.
And that reference to prophets of doom seen as a swipe at Greta and others who are constantly highlighting the problems facing the world.
Yeah, and it's seen by the US president, it seems to be very much the economy or the environment. He said about those prophets of doom that they want to see us do badly. And given that sort of the big message of his speech was about how well the US was doing economically, he said that he had created a roaring geyser of opportunity, saying that the US basically was doing better than it ever had before, et cetera, et cetera. It could be seen as an either-or equation, although the arguments a lot of other people have made that it's not an either-or. He's also come under some criticism from some adults, saying that, you know, very, very tempered criticism, it must be said. But Adina Friedman, the CEO of NASDAQ, is one who has said that where governments aren't acting, corporates are having to step in.
So I actually believe that because of the fact that the government hasn't been engaged in this topic, the corporate environment, the corporate world is realizing we need to take a much bigger role. And so
it's a good thing.
And no, it's not necessarily a good thing, but I think it is actually that when there is a hole that is created through one arm of this ecosystem not playing a role, the rest of the ecosystem finds a way to fill it in. And I do believe that companies are taking more responsibility because they realize that if they don't, who will? I think it's better if the whole ecosystem is involved and engaged and aligned. But when you have something where one party is not taking a stand, the other parties are filling.
That's Adina Friedman, the chief executive of NASDAQ, weighing into the debate at Davos.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Size Business Breakfast.
Let's talk luxury yachts now. Gulf Craft was founded back in 1982 in Ajman, making small fishing boats. Today it makes some of the world's largest and most luxurious super yachts. But there are big changes at Gulf Craft, changes in management. Joining us in the studio now is the acting chief executive, Abir Al-Shali. Abir, good morning. Thanks very much indeed for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And so we'll get on to what your future plans for Gulf Craft in a second. But these changes in the management are interesting. We've been covering Gulf Craft for a long time now. We were just talking, I've interviewed your father, Muhammad, the founder, NASA, your brother, Erwin Bamps, was the managing director or general manager for a long, long time. And now you're the acting CEO. Talk us briefly through the changes.
So basically, it's an ongoing process. You always talk about continuous process improvement in manufacturing, but that goes all the way up the chain. So the restructuring has to do with trying to basically respond to changes in the market, changes in the requirements of the company, changes in the way that we do business and the way that we build. So we looked at really the team and figured out that we needed some major changes. And my father and I have been working very closely over the past few years. And we reached a position where I feel we've built quite a strong team. We've hired Paul Gray as our chief operations. He comes in from a history working with really some prominent boat builders and has many years of experience under his belt. And we've also hired Nizar Taji, who also many years of experience under his belt working with prominent boat builders as well as marinas, great networking. And he's comes in as our chief commercial. And then I'm sitting there with my father as the chairman and me acting CEO. And the three of us together have put together a pretty good strategy going forward. And we're all really aligned and making a lot of changes, actually. So we've made changes throughout the company, but maybe those aren't quite as public and quite as, visible to everyone else as, you know, the big executive team change.
Well, I think what's interesting, and we were talking about this earlier, as a Gulf family firm, how transparent you're being about this. We don't often see the inner workings of mm-hmm. what's going on, but you've been transparent and said that Gregory Yeakel, who was the CEO for a short while, has left. Your head of sales has left after 20 years. What were some of the problems or challenges that you identified that you had to solve?
Well, we have a very niche industry. You know, it's not cars and it's not handbags. It's luxury and it's manufacturing. But like I said, it's very niche in the way that we do it. So it's a craft build. And at the same time, it's catering to some of the world's real top one percenters, ultra high net worth individuals. So it required a type of expertise and a nuance in the way that we handled ourselves that we needed to reach. And the team that we had wasn't quite there. They'd done, and I never like to talk negatively about people. They had done what they were able to do with what they had and what they knew how to do, but they weren't able to quite take us to the next step. So we really needed to make that change. And it's changing our strategy, changing the way that we work. I'm all about learning. So 37, 38 years, we didn't get here by not knowing anything, obviously. So we'd worked hard. We'd made some missteps, but we'd also made some really major changes, major successes. So going forward, I want to take those and learn from them and be very client-centric in the way that we work and very open.
In terms of your role, you're the acting CEO, and you are a member of the founding family, the Al Shali family. Yes. For the past 10 years, largely you've had outside management, Erwin Bamps and then Gregory Yeakel, and now the board of directors has chosen you as the acting CEO. How did that decision-making process happen?
It's kind of funny, actually. There was a little bit of pressure. I've been in the company, obviously, for a few years, working closely with my father and the CEO. So I was working with Erwin, I was working with Greg. And I think it just became more obvious that it really worked better this way. It was even the type of thing where the employees themselves were coming up to the chairman, to my father, and saying, you know, it makes more sense for us to report to her than to... So it was actually quite organic in the way that it happened. And I don't believe that this is necessarily the future of the company, that I'm always going to be in this position. And that's why it's acting CEO, because I want to be very transparent about that as well. That may not be my role in the future, but I am embedded in the company. I am a part of it. I understand my father's legacy. I understand his vision. And right now, I'm the best person that he has to kind of translate that vision into a strategy for the future.
So let's talk about what that strategy is.
Sure.
As you say, 40 years almost that you've been doing this and doing it very, very well. What's the top price, your most expensive super yacht? Must in the, what, tens or hundreds of millions of dirhams?
We have the Majesty 175 right now that's being built. It will be ready to show this year. And the Majesty 175 will be, when it's shown, one of the largest fiberglass yachts in the world. So in Dubai, we like the first, the biggest, the best, the tallest, the largest. And that's going to be another, checkbox on the list that this was built here. And it's something that we can show the world. And yeah, that is going to be quite highly priced, but still reasonable compared to if you were going to get that same yacht at another builder.
So what's the strategy going forward? How do you go forward?
Well, for me, it's client-centric. I am a big believer in lean processes, in elimination of waste, in cost-cutting, and in being everything that every step of the process needs to add value for the client. So to me, coming out with products that are required by our clients, where they say, I'd like a yacht that does this or a boat that does that. And that's what I see is our first area of growth, is to really respond to our clients' needs and not be too esoteric in our designs, or not be not innovative, but not to go too wild, you know, as you see sometimes happening. And the second thing is obviously to create a company that is very conscious of cost cutting, of being lean, and growing our own employees. Any company is only as good as the people who work there. Honestly speaking, that's what it comes down to. And I really believe in the people that we have, and going forward, growing them and creating learning opportunities for them.
Abir, there are so many more questions I have, but we're out of time for now. But please come back and field some more questions in the not-too-distant future.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
Abir Alshadi, the acting CEO of Gulfcraft, the Ajman-based luxury super yacht maker.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcast at DubaiEye1038.com.